We're back at the races, and we're back on the air after a, what was that, about an 8-minute, 10-minute Comcast delay or whatever. I know they had trouble. I guess they had a big storm last night in South Florida because Joe said she came into the studio and everything was fakakt, as we say in Yiddish. Hammer will come back, and we're going to have to obviously abbreviate. That was not a good time to lose 10 minutes because we were hard-pressed anyway. And as we wait for Rick, I want to thank everybody who came out for the Captain Gala last night before it gets too late. It was absolutely a delight and great fun. They kind of changed up a few things in terms of how it was laid out, and it made for a better evening even than last year. Thank everybody at the City Center, Bill and Betty Casey, who were honored, and Lisa Malloy from Rerun, and Shug McGahee and Allison for Easy Goer, the 30th anniversary of his amazing summer here, and also his great campaign that really picked up steam with the Belmont win, and then into the Whitney and Travers sweep, something that feels like we might not see again anytime soon. But, you know, it was done back then. Facing elders at that point in the season was, you know, I don't know, more just more pronounced, and not, it wasn't as big of an issue. But we had a wonderful time. I just sat with Shug, and it's always amazing to listen to him. I mean, his stories come up, and he told a story about the 1988 Breeders' Cup that I don't think he's ever told on the air. And maybe I'll save it about, you know, he had a win in 2 seconds. And one of the most famous days in racing history, when you think about personal ensign and winning colors. And he also finished second in two other, but he was walking along the racetrack. Hammer's back with us. And you know that when you leave the front side at Churchill and you walk to the backside, you know, you walk along the fence line by the stands. And Shug was kind of dejected, hard to believe that you win, you know, one of seven races on the Breeders' Cup. And it was a miserable day for those that were there. They'll tell you it was as difficult weather-wise, 36 degrees and windy and freezing rain and sleet and just awful, crazy snow. Hammer, were you there that day, 88 Breeders' Cup?
Absolutely.
How bad
great
was
day.
It?
Great
how,
day.
How cold?
You know
how,
what?
How cold were you?
You know what? I don't. It's part of the deal. I don't even think of it. It's just part of the. It was cold, but it's part of the. What makes it cool? It's not. It's not cookie cutter. That's for sure. And that's what makes it kind of neat. That was an epic day, though. Really was, especially when you look back. At the time, you know, it's good. But then, you know, as the years go by, and you look back, and you go, "Wow, what did we just see?"
Well, I'm going to save the intricacy of that story for Shug's next visit. I'll remind him to tell the story because it he said he was 37 years old and something happened that changed his philosophy and his mentality. But we had such a fun time last night. I'll put up some pictures later. Let's get back to it, Hammer, real quick. We got about 42 minutes. I've got to shove a lot of stuff in here.
Okay, you mentioned Shug and Allison. I mean, how can you not have fun? They're two of the funnest people around, and you would never think it, but they are. I mean, always in a good mood, right?
Yep.
Always in a good mood.
Mostly.
Anyway, well, yeah, like you said, we'll save that for later. Good people, good. But you mentioned the Del Mar meet real quick. You know, they had to make some decisions at the beginning of the meet, and Jay hit it right on the head. There was obviously when they went beyond racing decisions, and when people decided to come down, they make reservations, they make plans, they have groups, and so they decided to cut a race or two. I'm not real thrilled with the 7 races here and 8 races there, but you know what? It's a race day, and a lot of happy people. Just saw that. I was just looking at the favorite percentages of near 44%, which is pretty high. Sometimes when you stretch it out, you know, that's what happens. The racing's generally been good, but, you know, they're just, it's a new there's a new outlook out here, and you know, doesn't the bar isn't set quite as high at the moment. It just kind of, we just want to get over the bar at this point, and I think they've done that. A couple other things: Kentucky Downs made an announcement yesterday. They've changed their post time. Interestingly enough, Kentucky Downs meet starts on August 31st. And, you know, they only run for 5 days, but they talk about good at the stretch. They stretch it, go from August 31st through September 12th for 5 days. But they moved a post time. And at first, I was kind of wondering. So they moved it. It was 1:25, and now it's 12:15. But it's Central time, and anyone that's ever seen the line of demarcation for the time there, the guy must have stopped in a few bourbon parlors on the way through to Kentucky, because the line is all over the place. The timeline I'm talking about between Central and Eastern, so it's not as, I'm thinking 12:15, but it's really 1:15 on the East Coast. So last year and prior, it was 1:25 Central, a little late to get in on the action. So move that action up a little bit, 12:15 locally, helps the people that show up get home in a timely manner, and I think they'll be able to adjust the car a little bit better, stay away from Naira. So we're fans-friendly track, try and do things good for the fans and the better out there, and we'll get you down there for a day or two and see what it's like. I can't wait to get there and just, because it's going to give away a lot of money, and all races on the turf and full field. And you know, interestingly enough, it used to be called the Dueling Grounds. And you know, I looked that up, and apparently it was a Dueling Grounds. It was one of the four or five places in the country where if you had a problem, it was legal in Kentucky, wasn't legal in Tennessee, you would just step across the border and, you know, have a duel. And I mean, the best man win, and then go back home. But that name was changed. But it was the interesting read on that. Hollendorfer, I think you had Jay on this morning. He went as far as he could today. I believe is the actual hearing, and very interesting. You had mentioned the fact that Del Mar kind of got quote stuck with the end game on this, with Santa Anita being the one that tossed Jerry, and just an internal deal. They had an election a couple weeks ago for the CTT, and they had some new leadership in there. I believe Owen Hardy's now the new leader there. And then the next day, the lawsuit was filed, and Daryl Vienna did that. And I think Jerry's lucky that the CTT piled onto the lawsuit and really moved things along. And, you know, we'll see what this means short-term, long-term. You know, he had some horses in New York that Don Chatlos took over. Dan Ward, excuse me, is running some horses here. So things are going to happen tomorrow with as far as going back in, and we'll see how other tracks react to this. Now that he's quote, you know, the ban is, you know, when it gets lifted, how long it's for. Apparently, there's something in October where they're going to meet and finalize this thing. But, you know, it's pretty crazy. The beat goes on here, and I'm glad somebody stepped up, and we'll see what's going on. I just got a couple other quick things. I'm cleaning out my parents' house here, trying to get ready to put the house on the market. And lo and behold, I found a bunch of boxes with my name on them on the top, and you know, can't throw those out, of course. So a bunch of old stuff, a bunch of old racing stuff. And I have two things I wanted to mention. One, I found this book that was the book that I read when I was younger, you know, teens, that got me just enamored in the game. And it's a big, thick book called The History of Thoroughbred Racing in America.
Ah, it's the best. W.H.P. Robertson.
Yeah, W.H.P. Robertson. I'm telling you, when I opened that box and I saw this thing, I went, oh, my gosh, there it is.
$150. It's a $150 book.
It weighs about 5 pounds, and when I say that, it literally does. It's maybe, you know, inch and a half, 2 inches thick. And I remember reading this book from cover to cover, and it just, that was it. I said, I'm in. You know, drive me to the next track. So if you can, I was going to take a picture to cover. I'll put it on Twitter. I looked it up on Amazon. You can find them for used copies. Obviously, mine's well used, but just fascinating. It was written in 1964, I believe, and it goes back to the colonial times and it just goes over the horses and trainers and the history of the game. Just fantastic. I urge anyone to go out and punch it up. The History of Thoroughbred Racing in America. It's a black cover, and I mean, I was sitting right here in front of me. I started reading it last. Reading it till 2 a.m. last night, just rereading. It'll take you a while to get through, but if you're a lover of the game, beyond the betting standpoint, you're gonna be hooked. And then I found one other thing up there. I found a box of forms, and I reached in. I pulled out a form from Friday, June 17th, 1977. And you know, one of those big forms where you need a whole table to go on. I mean, that ironically, the headline is 16 go in Belmont's Bowling Green, Oceanport, 14 horses. But one of the things that caught my eye was My Juliet tops nine in a Pennsylvania race, right? And you had Tony Black on yesterday, so it got me going. And so I'm looking at this race. Is that Keystone? And it was a $25,000 stake race. And Jack Van Berg had sent a horse in, a filly to run, Regal Rumor from the Midwest. And keep in mind, this is a $25,000 stake race. There's nine of them in there. And my Juliet, so I says, you know what, I got to go see who won this race. So I check it out, went to the other Fantastic Book champion, and I look up My Juliet, and lo and behold, she scratched out of this race, right? And waited a couple of days and went into allowance race at Belmont Park and ended up winning that, and then came back and won in the Chamonix later. But you know, I mean, looking at My Julie, I mean, what a race mare. To hear Tony talk about her. He rode her for the last, I think, 11 times. But she ran against the boys. She ran against incredible. Interestingly enough, I look back and she ran in the Malibu out here at Santa Anita. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking. Right? And I'm looking, yep. And I go, wait a minute, that was 76. She was 4 years old. And lo and behold, I look at the date of the Malibu. They ran it in January back then, January 10th. So it was for four-year-olds, not three-year-olds. So it hadn't been moved to the earlier year, so it was for three-year-olds. I found that very intriguing. She didn't win that. She did run against the boys many times. She won the Vosburg, beat a horse called Bold Forbes in there. But what a race mare. She raced 36 times, won 24. So also on the cover of this is Gallant Bob versus What's Your Pleasure at Bowie. Right, we had the same day. Here's Gallant Bob, who was a champion sprinter, right? He's out there. He's running in a $25,000 stake race at Bowie. And, of course, then you got to look him up. And now he was an absolute war horse. He ran 77 times. He won 23 of them. Interestingly enough, I mean, he ran in 31 allowance races and 46 stakes during his career, and just pounded it out. And there's one other horse in here. I mean, now they talk about the Bowling Green. A horse called Vigers was in that race. Now, this was in 77, and Vigers was a turf horse, ran, you know, a nice turf horse. And then the next year, of course, he went on to win the Santa Anita Handicap under Daryl McHarg. And that's a YouTuber. That's a YouTube race. Go back and watch the 78 Handicap with the White Tornado. And I remember being there that day, and I remember going, Daryl McHarg won six that day. That was his sixth win. And at the mic was the one and only Dave Johnson, and he was in his prime then, and he sounded just great. And anyway, just so I got a lot of I'm pulling on Steve Haskin here for you, but I pulled this one form out, and I happen to have been in Atlantic City that night because I have to see my writing in there. So, you know, 42 years ago, whatever, I was down there at Atlantic City doing my deal. And anyway, a lot of it's amazing what one little thing will get you going. I've got books out. I'm watching YouTube. I'm looking up all this stuff just because of one little form. But fun times back then, and more fun times ahead. But I just wanted to talk about that stuff, and that's it. We're moving on. I'll be out there before you know it.
Absolutely. And I'm going to put up a picture of the book too. That I'm glad you found W.H.P. Robertson. It's the most thorough and complete history of the game that other than reading the multi-volume Racing
right.
America series, which yeah. is voluminous and incredibly in depth what's wrong with me? That's embarrassing.
I know what you're talking about too.
Yeah, and those are a fortune. They're $200 or $300 a volume.
Yeah.
This is within reach. And
on Amazon, you can get them from $10 on if you can, you know, depending on what kind of condition they're on. But probably $20 to ship it. It weighs a ton.
Hammer, I appreciate it, and sorry about the interruption. We'll talk to you next week.
We will. Thanks, Steve. Enjoy. Stay dry.
Rick Hammerly, everybody. Away they go. And we got to stay right here. We got too much going on. And see what Joe has been. Somebody's going to slip through the cracks here, and we're trying to find Nancy LaSala. I'll just remind everybody, it's the PDJF Awareness Weekend. So try to do what you can, I'll send out links. Let's say hello to Ed. Ed DeRosa. Haven't talked
hello.
In a couple of weeks. How are you?
Been a while, but brought me in for my favorite horse running tomorrow, so I appreciate that.
Well, tell
my
everybody.
Favorite horse in
training. That's it.
Yeah, Mattoli, excited to see him in the Vanderbilt cutting back. And I think one of the great things about this horse, Steve, we often lament, sometimes a little overwrought, sometimes legitimately, about horses not facing the best competition. But this is one in recent memory. I don't think you could poke any hole in the spots that Steve Asmussen and his team have decided to take on with this horse. To stretch out in the Met Mile against McKinsey, now catches Imperial Hint and a slew of challengers on the front end and chasing him down in the Vanderbilt. It's just a lot of fun to know that this horse is going to have to earn it every time he goes out. That doesn't mean he's worth a win bet at 2-5, but certainly appointment viewing for me tomorrow.
Oh, no doubt. What is worth a bet? Jump around and get us as much as we can.
Sure. Well, today in the curling, I'm gonna stick with looking at bikinis, hoping to get at least 2-1. We'll see. There's some names in there that hopefully will track money, including a stable mate. Definitely have respect for Intrepid Heart and Rowayton. But when this colt broke his maiden last year, Steve, I actually put him as one of those who likes to do early Derby lists. He was on it early in the two-year-old year and didn't work out. He didn't work back for a while and then came back. And I love the return, and the Brisnet numbers loved it as well. The type of pattern that Kerry Fotias used to write about called a reversal, where off a layoff they run faster than they had previously, and it portends for good things off the layoff and stretching out, and we're getting that today. So I think there's talent here, but it's the type of race, if I like looking at bikinis, I don't want to go any deeper than him. So he's my single in the Maltese for today, and we'll see if we can build something around it. As for tomorrow, I am against the favorites in the three-year-old race, the Jim Dandy. Not out of any disrespect. I just think in both instances they're going to be overbet. They're the known name. Tacitus was best on Belmont Day, had to settle for second. War of Wills, we know, was best on Preakness Day. And maybe they'll fire their best and we'll get a big show in the Travers. But in the Dandy, I just think they're vulnerable here for, you know, various reasons. I don't think either is that much faster. And in fact, with War of Will, he's always suffered from kind of numbers issues. So I think this is the time to play against them, and fortunately not overly creative beyond that. I've seen a lot of chatter about global campaign, and I agree with most of it. I kind of think this is the time for him. Just fits this race great. We know he can handle a mount in eighth. Now he has to do it around two turns, which I know is a question for some, but with the two horses in here who are clearly going to take money, I'm going to try to take advantage of that and play global campaign as the third choice. And then the last piece of the puzzle, stakes-wise, in the Bowling Green, very, very eager to see the workout reports on Chad's horse from Chile. We know Chad and his mentor, Bobby Frankel, have done well with the South American imports. Hard to think this one won't be any different. Want to see some positive reports there, but willing to stick with him in the Bowling Green.
Very good. All right. Anything else?
No, nothing specific pick-wise yet, but I am very much looking forward to Ellis Park adding a Monday date. I'm going to make the drive over there and doing a podcast tonight looking at that card, just trying to support them having to add a day with the cancellation or two cancellations last week. And always fun to hit Ellis Park for a day of racing. So be doing that on Monday. And for those who missed live racing at Saratoga on Monday, why not Ellis Park?
Why not? I hear you. And since you mentioned Ellis, I didn't get a chance to do it last week at the end of the week. But the announcement that came on Friday, a week ago today, $55 million in infrastructure support by the new owners of Ellis, and really nice news. There's been a lot of places, Texas, Illinois, and Kentucky on a steady basis, but the Ellis Park news continues to be terrific. You know, first came some support from Kentucky Downs sharing some of the HHR money, now Ellis with their own opportunity with historic horse racing, and ongoing future at Ellis. This is really welcome news. Laguna Development, Ellis Entertainment, and interestingly, they are letting the Saratoga gaming people who, you know, they bought the property from, they are letting them run the racing, Ed. I don't know how much conversation that's had, but they sort of leased out the racing portion.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're basically acknowledging that the racing part isn't really their bailiwick, so they're leaving it to the experts, and good. Sort of a similar parallel at Colonial, too. We talked to Jill Byrne this morning. So for everybody who seems that on the internet, everybody concentrates on as much bad news as they can dig up about the game. In the meantime, the reality, there's a lot of good news and a lot of good things happening.
Good things happening and keeping people involved who want racing to succeed. And with that type of agreement, you're sort of putting yourself on the hook to make that part of the business work, which ultimately is good for everyone. And in a loose segue to good news, I just want to echo your sentiments as I came on and encouraging everyone to support the PDJF. Been around some charities recently with my own family issues and just sort of feel like I have a good vibe for when people are in it for the right reason and the money's going to the right places when you give. And I definitely 100% get that when I talk to the people who benefit from PDJF and take the time to involve themselves and wanting that organization to do well. And looking forward to all the fun this weekend, but also looking forward to them raising a lot of money.
Ed DeRosa, everybody, EJXD2. Ed, good luck this weekend. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
We're going to stay right here. Barry Meadow is going to we're going to table Barry until next week. All right. Well, because I didn't want to abbreviate. I thought some really good conversations for Barry from his book, The Skeptical Handicapper. So we'll save it for next week. We're going to touch on two or three things, including the most appropriate pools for value and your bankroll. What, you know, based on your bankroll size, what pool should you gravitate to? And you know, where are you going to be getting the best bang for your bucks? We're also going to talk about how the smaller player can leverage takeout, how you can fight to get back against it and pick spots to your advantage. And you know, is it the double? Is it the pick three? We'll discuss that. The pick five is pick five, even though you get 15% pick five, you know, player friendly type pick fives. If it's too difficult of a bet for you to hit, maybe you're better off elsewhere. We're going to talk about that kind of equation with Barry, who is as knowledgeable about bankroll management as anybody. We're also going to talk to him about how the small to medium sized player can fight back against the computer assisted wagering teams, where, you know, we'll pull a Wee Willie Keeler, hit them where they ain't. And so we're going to get a lot of good stuff in with the next visit with Barry. And our next visit right now is with somebody who also is pretty darn savvy when it comes to bankroll application, Nick Tamaro.
Morning, Steve. How you doing?
Jesus, you sound like you sound like a Chilean miner.
I'm locked in my summertime handy capsule.
Handy capsule. That's very good. All right, you're out in California.
I am. Yeah, not stuck indoors for too long, but yeah, out in California, my usually annual Del Mar trip for the contest and getting out of the heat for a little bit, and yeah, the weather's looking up to it.
You know, speaking of visits and regional trips, what happened? You didn't qualify in Chicago? What went wrong?
No, I'll tell you, it was a little different than normal. Didn't ever really get anything started. There was just nothing. A couple of places on the Arlington card I digged, and they zagged and had a couple of strong opinions that half of it were right and not the right half got there, so yeah, it's going to be a little trickier finding a way back to the NHC now that the Arlington steam train seems to have ended. It seems to have reached its station. So we'll see. Still plenty of chances.
Well, plenty of chances, Nick, this weekend. And before we talk about Saturday, and you can go wherever you want, I'm assuming you've obviously must have looked at California, too.
Yeah, a little bit. We can definitely talk about both.
All right. Well, then we got about 17 minutes. Let's also get a quick synopsis from you about what you've been watching, what's gone right. I referenced you and invoked your comment from fairly early in the meet at Saratoga, by the way, about how the Kentucky-based claiming division is pushing everybody around over here, and evident again yesterday.
Well, no question about it. And let me tell you, I mean, since we've seen a real conscious effort on the part of the Naira Racing office, and believe me, this is not meant to be disparaging. It really isn't. I understand why Martin Panza and anybody else would want to gear a focus of a racing office towards turf racing, right? Turf racing offers bigger fields. It offers bigger opportunities for bettors, and we've seen that those races handle more money. Now, in Kentucky, they don't have the luxury of carding 5 to 6 turf races a day, both because there is only one turf course, and there aren't as many horsemen there that are interested in turf. So we've seen that the Kentucky claimers especially, and really even into the allowance ranks, and you know, taking a horse like Lucky Move yesterday in a New York bred race, we've seen them absolutely dominate so far, and I've been pretty surprised that it's been this dominant. I mean, we've gotten to the point now where you take a horse like Clayton the Lionheart last week, who won the last race on Friday, a 50 maiden claimer at Churchill, going to a 40 maiden claimer at Saratoga, and the two Churchill shippers ran 1-2. I know they were somewhat pace aided, but you know that pretty much sums up what's gone on with the dirt racing. It has been completely and totally dominated by the Kentucky shippers, and I think the public is getting a bit hip to it and is starting to really bet those horses down. I think the one that probably put everybody a little over the top, and this was a horse that was training well, so it shouldn't have come as a huge surprise, but when Scars Are Cool won on Sunday, That made it pretty clear that not only are the claiming races in Kentucky on the dirt stronger, but the maiden special weight races are stronger, right? They're offering deeper fields, they're more competitive, and the horses that have been running in New York just can't seem to cut the mustard at all. Now, on the turf, I think it's a different story, and I think the majority of those horses are winning that are coming from the program down at Belmont. But right now, if you're betting dirt races, you want to give everybody, every horse shipping in from a different location, a much, much longer look. And the crazy thing about that is that if you're a year-in, year-out player of Saratoga, it has never been this way. It's always been that you could always exclude the out-of-town horses, and it took an exceptional out-of-town horse to beat some of the horses that we see regularly in New York. Not the case.
I lost you just there at the end, Nick.
I was saying that's just not the case anymore, and you have to adjust accordingly in terms of whether you really have to take these out-of-town shippers. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, if we saw a horse coming from Park, it didn't really matter if they were dropping to where they were not even worthy of inclusion, not worthy of consideration, and that's not the case anymore at all.
We're losing you here a little bit, Nick. I don't know if you had a call coming in or what went on, but we lost you for a couple of stretches. Let's shift from...
Should be better now.
Yeah, much better. And the action this weekend, start wherever you want. If you got anything for today in New York particularly, this is a very good card. And the three races that came off the turf, they does not interrupt... the opportunities at all.
No, I think that pick five, late pick five actually is a very nice sequence. I think the turf race that kicks it off that is still on the turf is a pretty interesting spot, mainly because of Belon Rose, who's making her second start after being heavily overbet in her debut and losing as a heavy favorite. She apparently has been training very, very well, working with graded stake winners or graded stake types for Chad Brown, including Cumbier Park and Value Proposition. So I'm very interested to see if she improves with a little bit more ground. She was a little headstrong in her debut. I probably wouldn't have predicted that he'd send her a mile and 3/16 in her second start, but I'm guessing with that stretch out and distance that he knows a little something about what exactly she's looking for. It seems like Ocean Fire should probably give her the most trouble, being that she ran very well in her debut herself, lost to Catch a Bid, who's a Chad Brown horse that came back and probably should have won a one other than on opening weekend of the meet. And the feature races, speaking of Chad Brown, of course, who's not only leading the trainer standings, but has the two big contenders, I would say, in the Curlin. And I actually think that they're going to end up being the first two choices in here. I know that David had a really difficult time with the morning line because it is a contentious race. But looking at Bikinis and Highest Honors, to me, look like the two horses that you want to give the most consideration to. And I would say that being drawn inside in a race without really a confirmed front runner, except potentially Roatan being pushed to the lead. Looking at Bikinis, looks like he might win that race to the first turn, which is always advantageous at 9 furlongs. But I've been kind of stuck on Highest Honor since his debut. He had a very, very tough trip at Keeneland. Decent Midwest-type stakes horse. So I would imagine that Highest Honors will be a little bit more value in the multi-race plays, and I'm going to kind of concentrate my focus on those two. And a really good addition of the Curlin. I mean, if we get the top three finishers out of there, some of what was in the Jim Dandy and some of what was in the Haskell, it should really be an outstanding Travers.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. Anything else for today?
No, I think those were the main spots. The eighth is still on the turf. I think that's a pretty wide open race. Fears the horse to beat. Dowse's Beach is looks like he's a little long in the tooth, and there's pace expected, I'd say. So you would imagine that Fear will get a decent enough setup. I would definitely use the out-of-town horses in the seventh, including Righteous Ruby coming off the claim for Danny Gargan, who was very competitive against, I would say, comparable competition to Churchill, maybe a little bit weaker. But again, these class lines have gotten so blurred circuit to circuit, Kentucky to New York, that I don't want to get too stuck on that. And as far as the nightcap goes, the only horse I would say definitely to include off the turf with the 16 being scratched, sort of inexplicably, is Mr. Bobby, the Jimmy Bond trainee, who's a new gelding after running into trouble coming out of the gate in his debut. He should run significantly better second time out, and feels like he's found the right kind of spot with a bunch of these horses being sort of turfers with no direction and dirt horses with no ability.
Yeah, I among the prices, I thought there was something to like about Tailspin for Michelle Nevin.
Yeah, he set a fast pace last time, and she's always been decent enough off the layoff. Figures to be the inside speed. Hopefully Cancel can really commit to getting her in the mix from the start. Start getting him in the mix from the start, because that really would seem to be his biggest advantage.
Let's turn to Saturday, Nick. We've got about 8 minutes, so we can take our time and dive in. We've pretty much been starting with the Bowling Green. It's the race that I used for Beat Bic. You know what? You could qualify for – how would you like that? You could qualify for NHC and be the at-the-races representative.
The irony would be rather delicious. Yeah, that would be okay. I might have to hit my toe in the pool here. This is a really good race, and you know, it's one of those where I'm sure we'll see plenty come back in a sword dancer. There's grade one winners in here. There's just a number of horses that seem to be in form or trying to get back into form, and it really did end up coming together very, very well. I have no big issue with Sadler's Joy, who obviously is your selection. I thought that coming back off the layoff might be really the only big concern with him. He's run well fresh in the past, though, so there's no huge worry. I feel like three turns on the turf has always been his best game. I think his best performances have all come with that kind of setup. I think the firmer turf will certainly do him no great amount of harm, and he should get some pace in front of him. So there's all that you would need with him working for him. There's just a couple of horses, I think, with a little bit more recency that I'd be willing to try at better prices in any kind of gimmick or horizontal bet. And, you know, I think the conversation for me starts with Arklow, who amazingly, in a two-mile race, got into some traffic trouble when you would have thought that there would have been some time to sort it out. And he figures to be very, very dangerous from off the pace in here. He's pretty much good from anywhere from 10 furlongs on, and probably should have won the Man of War two back when really flying and drawn inside. Hopefully he'll be able to save some ground and can get a decent run through there. Like, I guess their long-term goal is to keep him going very, very long. And I thought Bigger Pitzer got into some traffic trouble at the wrong time in the United Nations. I know he got free just outside the eighth pole, but he was really wedged in behind horses coming around the turn into the stretch, and that was while Hunter O'Reilly was making the winning move. A Bigger Picture is a little bit more of a free-running horse that needs to get a clean trip, and like most horses do on the turf, of course, and Gaffleon gets back on after winning with him two back in the Elkhorn. So I'll take a shot there and see if we can inject a little bit of value, but obviously the principals, Channel Maker, Sadler's Joy, Arklow, they all make plenty of sense. If I can get maybe Bigger Picture in there a little bit of a price, it might juice up the exotics.
You're a sucker for Big Picture.
Well, he's a Houston horse, you know, so there's obviously, you know, it's funny, I've actually bet him very, very little in his career, and he killed me in the Elkhorn back in April. I didn't like him at all, and still have bad dreams of that early move on Red Knight around the turn and a little bit of an overly confident ride on Zulu Alpha. But, yeah, it'll be nice to see Bigger Picture. Bigger Picture ran very, very well in this race last year. And of course, he was among the number of horses compromised by that horribly slow pace and easy, you know, front-running, inside-drawn win last year by Glorious Empire, very astutely ridden by Julian Lethrew and the Sword Dancer. But this feels like something, a race that will be run at a little bit more honest pace and should offer everybody a decent chance.
What about the Jim Dandy?
You know, it's funny, I was watching replays yesterday and I went back and watched the Belmont and I think Jose Ortiz is a terrific young rider, and I think he's given a lot of very good rides in big races in his career. The ride he gave Tacitus in the Belmont was just embarrassing. Knowing that was an inside favoring track, he made no effort whatsoever to save ground. Tacitus ran a hole in the wind in the Belmont. Now, say what you want about the Belmont, it's a mile and a half, it's a somewhat of a unique race in that horses will never see that kind of setup, that kind of situation. I think Tacitus is the best horse in the race. I just think Global Campaign is going to beat him tomorrow because he's going to have a huge tactical advantage. And I think that in a mile and an eighth at Saratoga, that's going to be enough to really tip the scales in his favor. I don't know if they decide to send Global Campaign a mile and a quarter in a few weeks, if that'll be the same case. But again, I think it's a situation where he'll win the race to the first turn, and that will put him in the driver's seat. And I would imagine that Saez will look for a little bit of separation and look to, if he can establish it and put Tacitus at a point where he's got a lot of work to do, then I think that might just be enough. I did think, in fact, going back and watching, I was impressed with the race Tax ran in the Belmont. I didn't really notice it as it was happening. He did run very well and seems to be another horse that's pretty dangerous. He can settle just a little bit off the pace and might get that first run on the late movers. I think the only horse that's going to get that who you kind of want to take a stand against is War of Will. It feels like War of Will's best days might be behind him. I know he didn't get an ideal trip in the Belmont either, but, you know, we're looking at a horse that really did have a lot go his way in the Preakness and got the job done, but I'm still not altogether certain that he's going to move forward again in the second half of the year. Hats off to them for running him. I mean, he's danced just about every dance, but I think at this point you probably want a slightly fresher horse like Global Campaign, especially with that pace edge.
Can Matoli be beaten in the Vanderbilt?
I don't think so. I think the probably the only thing working against him is the rail, but when you've got his kind of speed, it shouldn't be too much of an issue. I guess the first quarter mile maybe will dictate what happens. If Strike Power's right on his hip and forces him to go a little bit quicker than he would like to, maybe that could be an issue. But the other part of it is who's really going to run him down? You know, it's. I think it's difficult to envision that Imperial Hint will be ready for something like that off of this kind of layoff. I know he ran extremely well at Saratoga last year in the Vanderbilt. That's a different scenario. He wasn't coming off a Dubai ship and a layoff after that. And the Imperial Hint that we saw in his last couple of starts was really not the one that we were dealing with a year ago. The horse that I'm going to try and partner with Matoli in the exact, and it might be a little bit of a price, is Duchere. And I think Duchere seems to be more effective at 6 furlongs than 7. Even a little out of position in the John Neighborhood being probably a little closer than he needed to be. So if he's allowed to just lay back and make one run, then he might be really the prime beneficiary of any kind of pace battle. I know that Firenze Fire is going to get some support. He's probably as good at 6 furlongs as he is at any other distance. He's just not, other than those isolated incidents, isolated races at Belmont where he ran very, very well, he's just sort of been okay over and over. And I don't know if against really top-notch, older-caliber sprinters in a fast-paced race, if he's going to benefit. I'd rather use a horse that'll be a little bit of a price like Duchere.
Anything else from Saratoga?
You know, the race that kicks off the late pick five, the eighth, is a good one other than allowance race. And I thought to put the glass down was interesting for Jeremiah Englehart, coming from Laurel. He moved early last time and got nailed right on the wire. That was not a bad field by any means. And this is a horse who should get some pace to run out in front of him. I think that might be enough to set him up. There's a lot of speed signed up in here. So if he can get a clean trip, maybe sitting just off of it, I think he'll be dangerous at a price. And that'll lead you into a multi-race sequence where, I mean, at least two of these stakes races feel like they're going to be won by horses at relatively short prices. So unless you like big bombs in the Bowling Green, if you can create a little value in that first leg, it'll go a long way.
All right. I have a couple quick Del Mar thoughts. We got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. Bing Crosby's a really nice race tomorrow.
Yep.
Recruiting ready, shipping across. Boy, the decision by Sagamore to go to Stanley Huff sure has worked on his. The pause always felt like he was doing a good job, but these horses have gone to another level. And the real question with recruiting ready is going to be if the pace heats up like it's supposed to. There's a lot of speed in here. Jalen Journey just to his outside to go along with Chief Chickatriz and Sistron and Calixman, who all really want to do their running on the front end. It feels like it's supposed to set up for Airstrike. Airstrike and Recruiting Ready, if Recruiting Ready can sit a little bit farther off of it, it seems like everything Flavian Pratt does right now is the right decision. They feel like the two. I think they'll probably end up being either the two choices or very, very close to it. And if Airstrike does offer a little bit of value, I'd kind of be inclined to go there. And in the seventh race, I'm going to bet Velvet Queen and Salsabella. Salsabella coming across country, new to the barn of Andrew Lerner, who's got a very high percentage stable, does very, very well with this move himself. And it's just one of those situations where you feel like Salsabella's been running against better turf horses. So between her having the class edge and Velvet Queen looking like she'll be on the front end, you might try and key those two. And in terms of the contest, play doubles or intra-race, a big exacta and some trifectas.
Can't argue, and I think players will have a fun weekend. The Sunday action we kind of hinted at here and there. Some important maidens going at Del Mar on Sunday. A very good Clement Hirsch. And, of course, here at Saratoga, the Amsterdam, which will feed in to the Alan Jerkins. And the Amsterdam's got some new faces. It's kind of fun. There's quite a few spots around, in fact, this weekend, where including that Crosby, like Jay Privman alluded to earlier this morning, you know, some new suspects as opposed to the usual suspects. So should be a lot of fun. Nick, good luck out there in the contest. I appreciate it, and we'll talk next week.
Thanks, Steve. Good luck to you. Thanks for having me.
NTAMM, N-T-A-M-M, 1215. I want to thank Nick and Ed DeRosa, Hammer, Mike Beer, Jay Pribman, Jill Byrne. We didn't find Nancy LaSala, even though she is somewhere in the Capital District, but she'll be on hand for all the PDJF activities, including the autograph session, which is very popular tomorrow, basically in the 11:30 to 12:30 range, over by that cupola, the overhang by the Jocks Silks Room at Saratoga. Bring goggles and pictures and all kinds of stuff. They'll also be usually they have that autograph book. I don't know if they did that this year, but jockey autograph session for a PDJF donation, and there's jockey karaoke coming, and awareness, pdjf.org. HRRN coverage, 3 o'clock this afternoon and tomorrow and down the stretch and more. We'll talk to you Monday at the races. Good luck, everybody.